Today we're talking with Chris Floyd. He's the author of Empire Burlesque, the great blog at chris-floyd.com, and the book Empire Burlesque, High Crimes and Low Comedy in the Bush Imperium. And you're in what part of England today?
I'm in Oxford.
In Oxford, England. Yep. And I was really happy to see on your blog today that you're talking about Gordon Brown. And, you know, we cover the dispute over the Iranian nuclear program on the show every day here, but we haven't really looked at the British angle, our closest ally, our most special relationship between the United States and Great Britain. And I guess some of the word has been here and there that the British perhaps are helping to restrain our actions by being less than willing to go along with a war against Iran, and I was just wondering, maybe you can fill us in and tell us about the new Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Not so new anymore, but tell us about Prime Minister Brown, his position on that.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of, I guess you'd call it wishful thinking about when Brown took over from Blair. You know, Blair slinked off about, I don't know, sometime in May or June or someplace like that, And then Brown came on. I remember reading over in American Press a lot of stuff. Oh, well, this is a new direction for, you know, Great Britain. He's not going to be as tight with Bush and all this kind of stuff. And he's not as personally tight with Bush. But as you say, there was also a lot of talk, too, that, well, Brown was going to restrain any move toward Iran. But as I wrote on the blog today, and I know you saw that, Brown gave his first major foreign policy speech last night at some big glittering affair down there in London. I think the Queen was there, and they were all in white tie and tails and, I don't know, top hats and canes, I reckon. But so he gave his first major speech, and he took that opportunity to align Britain once more, just shoulder to shoulder and hip to hip and whatever body parts they're putting together with Bush in Washington. And he also Britain wants to take the lead in thwarting Iran's nuclear program. They want to take the lead in, you know, cracking down and bringing more sanctions and to prevent Iran from processing uranium, you know, enriching uranium. And so he made a big show about that, that they want to be, you know, really tight with Washington on that. So I don't really think that there's going to be much if it'd be the same thing that happened before. If they decide to jump, if Bush says let's jump in Iran, then Brown's going to say how high, because he's just, as you know, but I don't know, a lot of people don't know, perhaps when Blair went out and Brown took over, they said, oh, this is a new man. Well, of course, Brown has been Blair's right-hand man, although they were hated each other, but, you know, they were the two top people for the whole way. You know, Brown ran the economy, Brown ran a whole lot of the domestic side, while Blair flitted around. But everything that Blair did, Brown had to sign on, because they actually have more of a cabinet government over here. You know, of course, in America, the cabinet doesn't really matter. They do what the president says or they get out. But over in Britain, they still have more of a semblance of a cabinet government. And so when the prime minister makes a decision, the cabinet has to sort of specifically sign on to it and take responsibility. That's the main thing. They have to take responsibility for it. And so everything that Blair did, you know, the war in Iraq, all this other kind of stuff, the helping with the renditioning and all this thing that they did, Brown had to sign off on all that, and otherwise he wouldn't be where he is. So, yes, this is our first big statement from Brown, and it's not very promising in the anti-war sort of area. And one other thing I was going to note about Brown, because people thought, well, when Brown comes in, he's more of an old-fashioned labor guy. That was another thing that you sometimes see in American press, and even here when he first came in. You know, he harks back to old labor, and as you know, labor used to be actually a socialist party until right before Blair was elected, when they dropped their clause about socialism out of their party principles. So they thought, well, here's, you know, Brown's going to be like an old line. But what Brown, one of the first things Brown did was he got a new economic advisor over here. He brought Alan Greenspan over here to be one of his economic advisors.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I mean, he signed on it, because he signed on a lot of these people. I'm sure Greenspan's not here every day, but yeah, he made a big, great show of having Greenspan over here to be one of his big economic advisors. So that'll tell you where he's coming at on the shock and awe capitalism front, because I've just been reading Naomi Klein's book. That'll tell you where he lines up on that sort of score, and his speech yesterday will tell you where he lines up on Iran.
Well, now, you know, the headlines over here were, Brown, we are still allies with America. And I thought, oh, well, was that in doubt? Do the people of England not want to be allies with America anymore?
Well, they don't particularly want to be. They don't want to be allies with Bush. I mean, I've never really seen anything like it. I mean, Bush is just, I mean, he's really hated over here. Hated or rejected as a joke or whatever you want to take it, depending on how politically active somebody is. But
yeah, one kind of contempt or another, though.
Absolutely. That's right. That's the way to put it, yeah. Yeah, one kind of contempt or another for Bush over here. And so, no, I mean, there's a great feeling of a great sort of falling off. I mean, of course, it's the same thing here as it is all over the world. Everybody loves American culture. There's no question about that. You know, everybody loves American culture. They love the movies. They love the music. They love the blues. You know, they love all this kind of stuff. Who doesn't? And they like individual Americans, too. You know, it's not some sort of visceral hatred like, oh, you're an American, get out of here. But, you know, they really, really despise American policy, and they despise what America has come to represent. And that's true right here, you know, where we have the so-called special relationship, which has always been a bit, you know, I think it's more of a specious relationship, actually, this special relationship. But always struck me as a bit funny, you know, that we cozy up to these people we fought a war to break away from. But what Brown is doing, again, what Brown is doing here, he's showing that what's more important for the British, let's just speak plainly, the British ruling class, what's more important is to line up with the American ruling class than it is to do what his own people want to do, which is not be shoulder to shoulder with Bush and things like that.
Well, I wonder if there's anything specific that they're working on here, like a big arms deal with Saudi Arabia or something again.
Well, of course, they've got that going through. I mean, that's just the thing that I've written about a whole lot. As you know, with Tony Blair quashed this two-year investigation in the sort of what they have over here, the serious fraud office, well, which we could actually use one in America, I guess. But they worked for 2 years to find out. But, oh, you know, I mean, I'm sure you probably read about the massive corruption with these Saudi royals, the billion-dollar slush fund for Prince Bandar, who's also known as Bandar Bush because he was so close to the Bush family. $1 billion they just put in a slush fund for him to, you know, play around with, all this kind of stuff. But Tony Blair quashed that investigation, and now under Brown, of course, the sale of 72 fighters, I think it is, for, I can't remember the exact dollar term now, X billion dollars, $12 billion or something like that, has just gone through. And, of course, the Saudi king was over here a couple of weeks ago, and Brown was paying his obeisance to the Saudi king. It's a really remarkable thing. If you think that the Saudi Arabia is one of the most repressive, extremist, religious tyrannies in the whole world, and the way that you can see these, you know, these great figures of state over here falling over the king who came, it's just, you know, I mean, they might as well be rolling up the red carpet for the guy in Korea if they're going to do that sort of thing. But so Brown was there, again, in white tie and tails, doing his penguin imitation, and they were signed. That's basically the reason the king came, I think, was they could sign this big deal for more jet fighters for the Saudis and more massive, massive kickbacks to the Saudi royals.
And what's the name of that company again, the British company doing the fighters?
Yeah, BAE it's called. BAE.
Right, BAE Systems.
I think it used to be British Aerospace, but its official name is BAE. And it's also, it is a British company. It's their top, it's sort of like their Lockheed Martin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Blair cut a lot of sweet deals for them over the years. But it's also one of the major defense companies in the United States also.
Well, and wasn't it the case that they were having some financial troubles and that this whole thing basically just amounted to a giant welfare check to save them?
Well, I don't know. I'm not quite sure on that angle. I mean, I know they are, what they are having. They're having a lot of troubles in the United States because the United States is investigating some of this. The Justice Department or somebody over there is investigating some of this kickback stuff that they've buried over here. I don't know if that's just to light a fire under, you know, somebody in Saudi Arabia to get a better kickback for something else, but... Well, yeah, BA has been up and down, but in the last few years, you know, they've done like all the other weapons companies in the United States and Britain. They're flush with cash now from all the war stuff, you know, because they're in charge of so much over here.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry because I'm not positive about the footnote, but I think it was Richard Cummings' article in Playboy magazine, Lockheed's stock and two smoking barrels. I think that's where he talked about BAE's financial troubles and this giant... welfare fund from the American taxpayer to this British airplane company to sell some jets to the Saudis.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. I mean, as I say, I'm just dealing with it from the last, little bit, because if he goes back to, the original deal from this started back under Margaret Thatcher. It's a 20-year. Actually, what we're talking about now, today, this latest sale is just a renewal or a rolling over of a 20-year deal that's been going on.
Oh, wow.
So I'm sure that's been used all the years as a cash cow to pull BAE out of, pull BAE out of the mud and everything. And I'm sure you were just reading Playboy for the articles, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I read it online, and I didn't want to get a virus. So here's the funny thing about America and Britain as well rattling the saber about Iran and their nuclear program is that, Dr. Gordon Prather explained on the show today, our nuclear expert at antiwar.com, he says, about referring to my government and the one you're living under over there, he said, they know they're lying. There is no evidence that there is any sort of secret nuclear weapons program, or even that the safeguarded and declared that everybody knows about nuclear program that they do have would be capable of making nuclear weapons anytime within years and years and years from now.
Well, of course, absolutely, he's right. I mean, this is again the sort of frustrating thing about the whole thing is they are lying. And as I was mentioning in my piece today, you know, what we're seeing is the same thing we saw with Iraq is they're simply manufacturing a crisis where one doesn't exist, and they're manufacturing a crisis over non-existent weapons or non-existent weapons programs. The exact same thing that happened before. And as you say, they are lying about it. And I hoped I'd made this point today when I was talking about Brown. My point was being that he has bought into that lie, and he knows they're lying. You know, he knows what's going on. And so this, I think, tells you all you need to know about Brown, because he's bought into the lie, and now he's pushing the lie. And I'm sure that Gordon Prather also mentioned either today, or I know he has other times, that as you say, there's no evidence that Iran is doing anything illegal, and everything they are doing, they're allowed to do by treaty. And as I mentioned today, and I'm sure he's mentioned before too, they've actually gone the extra mile. They've actually accepted more restrictions than they needed to do under the treaty already. And so this whole crisis about what the UN Security Council is demanding of them and they're being intransigent, it's the fact is that they're balking at a few more extra restrictions that by treaty they shouldn't have to obey in the first place. I mean, you know, I'm like a lot of people, I'm not here beating the drum for Iran as a, you know, this wonderful regime or something like that, but that has nothing to do with anything. It has nothing to do with what they're being accused of or anything like that. And of course, I did mention this today too, everything that Bush and now Brown are doing only strengthens the hardliners in Iran, only makes it, you know, only makes the regime more repressive and strengthens the hardliners. I don't know if you saw in the piece I did today, I was quoting from a Guardian article about how Bush deliberately and knowingly sabotaged Putin's trip over there. You know, Putin went to Tehran last month, and he had a deal that he was going to try to work out, and he told Bush beforehand about this deal. He said, it's the same deal they had before. He says, you know, we'll offer to Iran that we'll enrich uranium for them on our soil, and
right.
they'll have their nuclear power plants, but we'll enrich the uranium that way there's no possible way in the world they can make a bomb. And so Putin told that to Bush before he left, and Bush said, yeah, you look into that. If they'll go for that, then we'll sit down and talk to them and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we'll enter into talks with them if they'll agree to suspend their uranium enrichment. So Putin took that deal to Khamenei, because he met the top dog. He wasn't dealing around with the Iranian president, you know, who doesn't have the power to do any of these things that he talks about. He doesn't have the power over the nuclear program. He met with the supreme leader there, Putin did. He put that offer to him, and Khamenei said that he'll consider it. You know, I'll think about it. We'll take it under advisement. We'll think about it. So they were dealing with it. I mean, they were in negotiations with him. And then during that period, that's right after that, that's when Bush came out with his outlawing bits of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, you know, the Revolutionary Guard, which is such, you know, part of the Iranian government. He declared them a terrorist organization.
Mm.
And so what happened then was all the hardliners came in and said, look, you can't negotiate with me. You can't negotiate. You can't do anything. You know, we're right. You know, all you people trying to talk with Americans, you know, you can't do it. And so what happened was it strengthened the hardliners, and the sort of moderate nuclear negotiator that the Iranians had, he was kicked out.
Right.
And they brought in one of the Iranian presidents, you know, top men. So everything they're doing is strengthening the hardliners. And as I mentioned in my piece today, they're doing that on purpose. You know, everything they're doing is they're trying to systematically close off every option except war.
That's
you know,
right.
It's like some sort of perverse reversal of what you think foreign policy is. You know, it's about to try this. You know, it's to try to find every measure short of war before you have to go to war. But what the Bush people are doing is they're trying to but wipe out every measure that could lead to peace, so they leave only one option to resolve this crisis that they themselves have manufactured and that they themselves are keeping going through lies and deceit. It's a really amazing sort of thing, and I just don't see, you know, I know a lot of people saying, oh, well, it looks like they're not going to attack now, oh, I don't think they'll attack now. But I don't see the reason of going through all this rigmarole, unless they're going to attack. I don't see what's the point of going through all this. They're just going to run out the clock with Iran. They could do a whole lot easier stuff than this kind of thing. But they're not interested. They're not interested in any way negotiating. They're not interested in getting rid of the Iranian nuclear program. They don't care. I mean, you know, the Americans helped start the Iranian nuclear program 30 years ago when the Shah was there. They don't care. What they are interested in is getting rid of the Iranian regime and getting control of Iran. That's all they're interested in. And so, I mean, that's where all this stuff is pointing toward. And but as you know, and I'm sure you say it every day, you know, we've seen all this before, and it's just like a really bad dream. It's just happening again.
Well, but let me ask you here, because when you say it's all pointing toward an attempt at regime change in Iran, I'd have to say it's only kind of pointed generally in that direction. I mean, you hear talk of limited airstrikes, and then, of course, the obvious answer to that is, well, how limited is the Iranian response going to be if we start bombing them? And I wonder, do you think that the plan is to deliberately escalate into a full-scale regional war and go ahead and start a draft and attempt to occupy Persia? Or are we talking about another coup d'etat they're going to try to engineer? Because that doesn't seem very likely.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, of course, I don't know one way or the other because I have no entree to the corridor of the power there, but... Yeah, I mean, I think that comes down to the question is, are they want to provoke some sort of conflict. I mean, that's obvious. And the question is, are they stupid enough to believe that if they do that, that the regime is just going to crumble and that people are going to welcome them again with the flowers and candy? And maybe they do think that. I don't know. I don't know what they think will happen. I mean, there's part of me, I think, that they think that it doesn't matter what happens. What does it matter? You know, they go in. Either the regime crumbles, the regime doesn't crumble, you got a bigger, wider war on your hand. You know, what do they care? We're talking about, again, you know, to revert back to Naomi Klein's book, we're talking about the disaster capitalism complex, aren't we? And I've written about this, actually, not nearly as well as she or in depth, but for years I've been talking about how the Iraq war has always been a win-win situation for the Bush people, you know, the Bush faction, is that if the war succeeds, great, they've conquered Iraq, you know, and they've got the whole new playground, they can suck all the oil out there like a milkshake through a straw. Now, but if they don't conquer, if there's a lot of trouble like we've seen the last few years, well, great, you know. They just make billions and billions of dollars. Halliburton makes billions. Lockheed Martin makes billions. Bush gets to have more and more power as the war president. You know, it's a...
Well, and the price of oil quadruples.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, it's like some, you know, self-perpetuating machine, perpetual motion machine. So if they were to attack Iran, you say, you know, what happens is we in the reality-based community, we lay out all the possible options, right? Well, it could be a limited response by Iran. They could launch terrorism all over the world, or they could come back with a, you know, massive strike. They could help the Shia in Iraq, you know, wipe out our troops. They could do this. They could do that. You know, we look at the options and we say, well, you know, how could you do, you know, which would be the worst, or who would take this step, you know, because it would lead to that. But what they see is that, well, if we do this, we get X amount of money. If we do this, we'll get more money. If this happens, we'll get X amount of money. If this happens, we'll get X amount of money. Everything, you know, they'll just make... they've already shown in Iraq they don't care how many American troops die. They don't care how much they exacerbate the risk of terrorism to Americans, because we all know that terrorism has been on the rise year after year, and we all know all these studies, even the Pentagon's own studies, show that the war in Iraq has exacerbated and radicalized extremist Muslims all over the world. So they don't care about that. They've proven already they don't care about American lives. They don't care about terrorism. They do care about, again, I'm just borrowing her terms, you know, their disaster capitalism machine. They keep it rolling. And so, you could lay out 5, 6, 10 options about, you know, what would happen, worst-case scenarios in Iran. But for them, the worst-case scenario is always they make more money and they get more power. I mean, what do they care? In the end, what do they care? So, you know, you and I, we sit around and we can discuss these strategies and what they would lead to. But I think they're coming at it from a different paradigm, actually.
I guess the question is really, I mean, even if they're only that self-interested, they have to see that there's a chance or a possibility that they're going to kill the golden goose, that they're going to take the empire too far and blow it up, and then they won't have it anymore.
Well, absolutely. I mean, of course, that's true, too. But, of course, if you look in history, what empire has ever had the wisdom to stop before it stretched too far, you know, before it killed the golden goose, before it ran into somebody else that took it down, you know?
None I ever heard of.
No, I know. That's what I mean. I mean, that's, you know, you read about, even, you know, I mean, you talk about Rome, or even you talk about the great commercial empires before you, Spain and Holland and all these places, you know, they always go on to kill the golden goose at some point. Because, you know, you never can tell where that point's going to be. And so, yeah, of course you're right. I mean, that could happen. But you know what? In another way, though, this small elite, even if they kill, you know, the golden, I mean, they'll have a golden parachute. You know, they won't go down. They won't go down with it. You know, they'll always be living in little enclaves and little islands and lily pads, unless some sort of, you know, gigantic worldwide conflagration sweeps everything away. But yeah, no, of course. I mean, that's the, you know, that's the sort of thing we're living under. Well, gosh, when finally are they going to go too far? And of course, when they go too far, all that means is that, you know, we're all going to get it in the net, because that'll be a huge disaster. So it's not, I don't know, it's not a very fun time these days.
Well, you know, I don't know if people on this show are getting sick of it yet or not, but I guess I have to mention that the American people now have a golden opportunity on a silver platter right in front of them to turn the empire around, to say, wait a minute, we're gonna stop and get this right before we get to the no U-turns marker, and
yeah.
Restore our republic. It's right in front of our face. They're calling it the Ron Paul Revolution, and I don't know whether it'll get strong enough in time to actually make him the president, but there's a lot of people, it seems like, who are willing to put their culture war aside and willing to put other various issues aside to unite around, hey, let's keep it simple here. We need to make sure to keep our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, and if we have to end our empire to do that, let's do that.
Well, I mean, of course, that would be great if that happens. I just don't, I personally don't see it happen, because I'm not in America, so I don't have my finger on the pulse over there and see how much this is, you know, it's hard for me seeing that if the Ron Paul thing took off, you know, even more than it has so far. I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to be completely cynical or all stuff like that, but, you know, I did write a piece about this a few months ago about what's about Ron Paul specifically. It was about, you know, all the people that were, it said anyone who seriously challenges, you know, the power structure in that way over the last 30, 40 years, what happens to them? I mean, anyone who mounts a serious national challenge to that sort of thing, you know, what happens to them? You know, Martin Luther King, when he started talking about not just civil rights, oh, yes, that's great, or we'll let the blacks drink at our drinking fountains, but he started talking about economic justice, and he started talking about Vietnam, and he started saying that, you know, well, you know, our country is killing more people in the world than anybody. You know, what happens to people like that? They get taken down, they get... things happen to them. Either maybe nowadays they don't have to bump them off. They just sort of, I don't know, manufacture some video on YouTube of him having sex with a 12-year-old or something. I mean, you know, I mean, these things kind of happen. I just don't see them allowing that sort of thing to take off. But I mean, I could be wrong, and of course, I hope that I'm wrong. I hope that we have some sort of uprising in that sense to restore the Constitution. I mean, that's one point I guess I always sometimes need to make. I don't make it enough, but. Is all these things that I talk about, you know, when I talk about Iran and I talk about the death of the American Republic, and you know, these are things that I'd be more than happy to be wrong about. You know, I mean, it's not like I don't have some great pleasure from it. And if we do go to war to Iran, I'm not going to be jumping up and down and say, look, I told you so. I mean, it's horrible. It's a horrible thing, and it always reminds me of Bob Dylan's lines about Lenny Bruce. You know, when he said he fought a war on a battlefield where every victory hurt. You know, I mean, this is kind of the way it is. I mean, who wants to win these sort of things? Who wants to be right about these things? And so if I'm wrong about, you know, the way they were able to stop these sort of groundswell things, I hope I am wrong about it.
Well, you know, I tend to come from your same point of view. But, you know, I have to give James Madison a little bit of credit. I mean, ultimately, it does come down. At least, well, I guess they changed the primary system. Never mind James Madison and his credit. But it does come down basically to who shows up to vote. It comes down to one man, one vote.
Well, it comes down to it comes down, and you know, in the final end, it does come down to the people. It comes down to what the people will accept, what they'll swallow, and what they won't swallow, and what they'll do to stand against it. You know, and that's another reason why. I mean, I don't, you know. The last few years don't exactly fill me with the confidence on that score either. But I don't know. We'll just have to see. Of course, I'm very happy that something really, you know, gets rolling on that. Anything, as you say, that rolls back the empire, this military empire of bases and dominance we've built over the last several decades, bipartisan empire. Anything that rolls that back, anything that, you know, is aiming to restore constitutional law, you know, I'm all for it.
And, you know, Ron Paul actually says himself that, well, you know, the empire probably won't end because everybody listens to me, but it will come to an end. And it's simply because we're not going to be able to afford to take over the whole world. It just doesn't work that way. And looking at Pakistan, looking at Georgia, looking at Somalia, I mean, just in this week, never mind the situation in Kurdistan and Turkey, it just seems like the American empire is absolutely falling apart at the seams today.
Well, it's having a lot of, yeah, it's having a lot of problems. But, again, I think, I mean, yeah, I'm not making some, any deep analysis right now of that sort of thing, but it's, I mean, it comes down to what the empire is in that sense. If you think about it in terms of being a successful empire or it's going to bankrupt the country, you know, as Ron Paul says, yeah, it could bankrupt the country. But again, you know, again, from reading, again, the Shock Doctrine, where she goes into all this history of, you know, how these free market fundamentalists took over country after country, they bankrupted their own countries. But the elites didn't care. You see, they always
Don't call them free market. There's nothing free market about fascism.
No, but I mean, free market fundamentalism. What they call them? No, of course it's not. I mean, it's gangster capitalism. But I'm saying what they call themselves. You know, we believe in the free market. The free market believes. You know, of course, what they really believe in is taking control of the state to enrich themselves and their cronies. I know.
Uh-huh.
But I'm saying that I feel more and more that I don't think the Bush. I'm calling the Bush faction, you know, as representative name of all this faction, this sort of thing. I don't think they mind too much if the country gets bankrupted. I mean, you know, the more they hollow out the government, the more they hollow out the economy, and the more money for them. You know, I just I don't know, but yeah, it's true. But you're absolutely true that if they do want to actually dominate the world and manage the world, then of course they're doing a really horrible job, and it's all kind of flaring up on the borders and. But again, as I said, you know, this is not a great situation either. So it's, you know, there's danger at every turn.
Well, yeah, and it's really interesting your point about how danger at every turn is just fine. Oh, if they spread Al Qaeda like kicking over an ant pile, you know, and make everything worse along that front. Oh, that's okay. If there's another depression in America, well, that's all fine too. They get to buy up everybody's stuff for pennies on the dollar.
Absolutely.
And no matter what happens, the people who control the state figure they're going to stay on top no matter what. And really, they're better off when things are on fire and people are dying.
Well, absolutely. I mean, again, that's the whole point of the of that book, of Naomi Klein's book. And again, I'm sorry to keep referring to it. I just finished.
Well, it's okay. I have it sitting here, right here on the shelf, but I haven't gotten a chance to read it yet because I'm still reading Chris DeLisso's book. But
yeah. Well,
she's next
book.
On my list, though.
You will know a whole lot of it, and a lot of your listeners will know a whole lot of this history, but it really puts it together very succinctly, and it shows the sort of economic warfare aspect of it. But yes, you're right. I mean, that comes down to it, is that, again, over and over, it's this win-win situation, and we have to somehow address that. We have to somehow make it not a win-win situation, and that's what I'm not quite sure how to do in this at the moment.
Yeah, I really don't know either, other than to have, you know, super majorities of the American people, you know, living and breathing and dying by the 10th Amendment or something. It's just not going to happen.
Well, I know, because what has to happen is that your institutions have to work. I mean, these people have to be brought to justice to make it pay. So you have to say, well, if you take over a country like Bush has, you know, seized our country, and if you do this, you know, if you cause wars and if you do all this like he does, then you have to show these leaders that they will pay for it. You know, they'll go to jail, they'll be executed, whatever happens to them. You know, I mean, whatever justice is determined, you know, but if our institutions are broken, which is what I keep talking about in a lot of this, you know, death of the Republic thing, as we can see, you know, our institutions aren't working, then who's going to hold them accountable? You know, is the Congress, the Democratic Congress, are going to hold them accountable? The Supreme Court going to hold them accountable? You know, the institutions are broken, and is the corporate media going to hold them accountable? You know, I've mentioned this over. Why are they treating Bush and these as if they were legitimate, respectable leaders of a country instead of a gang of thieves? And why aren't the Democrats in Congress, you know, on strike and say, look, we're not going to deal with this. These people are illegal. We're not going to treat with you. We're not going to deal with you. You know. Only laws we're going to deal with are impeaching you, and then we'll go back. But they don't do that. They, you know, the president, this, we need to negotiate with the president. I mean, so if your institutions are broken, this is what is so despairing about it. It's not just you have a group of tyrants and authoritarians who've taken over power, it's that all the other institutions won't stand against them either. And of course, anyone who knows, you know, a little bit about Roman history, and that's all I know is a little bit, you know, we've seen this sort of thing before where the institutions no longer function against an authoritarian force, and there you go. Then there's your republic. And, you know, you can read about it in the history books one day.
Yeah, the problem is the anticipation of the day when all that warfare state is turned inward against us.
Oh, well, now there you go. I mean, I think that's coming, too. I think we're already seeing some of that, you see. I mean, we're seeing the, you know, the Blackwater on the streets of New Orleans is like a canary in the mine shaft, you see. I mean, you know, this kind of thing is what's coming. Is as more and more of the services, more and more, you know, of law enforcement and authority and stuff, they are turned over to these private companies, and also they're turned over to, and you know, in the state, you know, we have our own military command over the United States now, which we've never had before. What's it called? The Northern Command, you know.
Right.
And of course, you know, Bush has signed all these decrees. What did he sign one last year, you know, that gave him the authority to take over the National Guard, not only in the case of, you know, and to declare martial law, not only in the case of insurrection, which was the only way before, but, you know, natural emergency or even, you know, riots and political uprising. I mean, they basically gave him the power to declare martial law anytime he feels like too many people are getting out of line. I mean,
right.
This is what's been done. And so, yeah, you're right. Oh, it's coming home, all right. You know, it's coming home.
Yeah, it even said, I think, at the end, or other purpose.
Or other purpose. You know.
That's a little vague.
Yeah. Yeah, if the president wakes up in a bad mood this morning, he can declare martial law, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, another big symptom of the end of even the pretense of a rule of law restraining the power of our government in this country is the acquiescence of the Democrats in the Imperial Senate to Bush's next pick for Attorney General.
Oh,
and, of
God,
course,
yeah.
When the fate of the free world is hanging on Charles Schumer's shoulders, you shouldn't, you know, hope too deeply for that. But so here we have this guy, Mukasey. He's been confirmed now. And this is a guy who, correct me if I'm wrong, has basically told the Senate that he wasn't quite sure whether or not statutes bind the president's authority in a wartime.
Oh, he's already made, I know he's already made rulings to that effect when he was on the bench, and he told him that. And so, yeah, you have, he's a double whammy, you know. He's already on the record as saying that you can't really restrict the president's power in wartime. And, of course, we know this war will never end. And he's also, and we know the thing about refused to condemn waterboarding, which has been condemned for hundreds of years to people as torture. And so, again, you mentioned the Imperial Senate, and it's really true. I tell this story often. You know, the Emperor Tiberius, when he was when he first took power after Augustus died, he was the second emperor, and the Senate voted all these powers, you know, all these unlimited powers, and he said to them something along the lines of, you know, how can you vote this on one man like me? What if I go crazy? You know, what if I, you know, you can't give all this power to me, you know, and give up all this power. They said, oh, no, we want you to have it, Caesar. You have it, Caesar. And his answer to that was, you know, men fit to be slaves. And that's what we have in the Senate now. You know, I mean, men and women, let's not leave out Dianne Feinstein and all these people. They're wonderful. And Nancy Pelosi, you know, we have people fit to be slaves, and that's what they are. What can you say? I mean,
hey, they're dragging us down with them.
Yeah, well, someone mentioned the other day, how can it be that we have headlines where it says, you know, Democrats question Attorney General on torture, you know, his position on torture. How could that possibly happen? You know, how do you get the situation where there's headlines like that? Well, like, oh, it's just a normal part of our politics. You have to ask the Attorney General of the United States where he stands on torture. I mean,
right?
Where do you stand on the ritual cannibalism of prisoners' children or something like that? You know, well, you know, if you, you know, we got one of Osama's children here, and we fried him up and ate him in front of him just to make him talk. You know, it's Jack Bauer did it on television. Now we have to do it too. You know, so, I mean, I don't know. I've thundered in outrage so many times about these Democratic cave-ins and these whatever you want to call it, you know, this slavish behavior. That by the time Mukasey came around, I hardly know what to say. What can you say about it? What else can you expect? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you're right. It's not even his horrible answers. It's the fact that these are even the questions.
No,
I mean,
I know,
what are we
right.
talking
like,
about?
Like, you know, forget the answers. Why are we even asking these questions? But
yeah, everybody knows that the Constitution itself bans torture.
Of course it does. Of course it does. And all the other treaties that we've accepted after that, you know, they all become part of bedrock American law. I mean, there's no question that it's all banned. There's no question that waterboarding itself is torture. and his band. I mean, it's just, no, there's no question. That's what I mean. So, but what can we do in a situation where all our institutions, the Congress, the court, and the media, you know, the establishment, where they just accept this? You can have, oh, well, every now and then Washington Post will publish, you know, a nice editorial about against torture, and then Fred Hyatt will, you know, undercut it with his own editorials. But, you know, oh, yeah, we can have a little voice here, a little voice there. Oh, we can have our little internet here. We can do this kind of stuff. But, I mean, what can you do in the commanding height of the establishment of your country? Simply accept these things. And even if they don't like it, even if they're at the Yale Club and they say, oh, you know, it's kind of awful, isn't that? Yeah, oh, gosh. But they don't do anything about it. So whether you dislike it or not, you know, whether they frown upon it, you know, in their boardrooms and clubrooms, doesn't matter. It's accepted, you know. It's accepted. And the people who are pushing this torture and this tyranny and these authoritarian, they are treated with respect. They're treated with honor. They're treated as if they are legitimate holders of legitimate representatives of the people. And it's just not true. And so, but, I mean, what can you call it but a surrender? And, you know, it's just a surrender of the commanding heights, as I say, of a society. And what is that but the death of a republic? You can't call that a republic, can you?
Yeah, it really is amazing. I saw on your blog you referred to Michael Massing's article about Americans' willful ignorance. And it really is amazing to think that in a country with this much infrastructure, this many different private entrenched interests in different places all around and all the different regions and all the different powers. I mean, never even mind, the conflict between the state and federal governments and the different individual offices and that kind of thing. It just seems like the natural checks and balances of the society itself, of the varied private interests around the country, would somehow keep a temper on this. Is it just the fear? Is it just because they get on TV and say this terrorist is going to bomb you? Or what is it that makes Americans willing to watch the death of their Republican in silence?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a huge question. You'd have to. I mean, there's all sorts of things that play into that. The fear is part of it, but you know, I mean, part of it is just the whole idea. Anyway, I mean, a lot of people would say that the Americans surrendered the Republic long, long ago. You know, I mean, they just allow people to tell them what to do, and they just don't care as long as they, as long as they have a little bitty slice of the pie. But I don't know. But I think one thing what Bush and them have proven, and what we've been proven over the last few years, is that. All these tyrannies we saw in the 20th century, you know, the Nazis and the Soviet, they were overkill. You know, they didn't have to go after people that hard. You know, if you just sort of, as you say, if you scare them a little bit and overawe them a little bit, and if you're willing to, you know, disappear a few people now and then you can get your way. You don't have to actually control everything. People, you know, you can, let them have a free speech. You want to have free speech, that's fine. You want to make some movies that make us look bad, oh, who cares, you know, because it doesn't get to where the real power is. What do they care, you know? I mean, somebody makes a movie. Robert Redford makes a movie and it makes $5 million. Lockheed Martin makes $25 billion, and they pour half of that back into the political system. You know, what do they care? I mean, they don't care. I mean, you know, it doesn't get to them. But I don't know. I mean, there's some sort of broken will in American people. I don't know exactly where all that comes from. It just doesn't all come from September 11th, of course. There's also the case, too, though, is that I've mentioned this a few times, is the state. It's so powerful now. You know, it's powerful by several orders, more powerful by several orders of magnitude than it was even a few decades ago. I mean, if you just, you know, if you stand up against it, they'll just squash you. They can squash you like a bug, and it's just very hard for individual people to stand up for that sort of thing. You know, it becomes easier to say, oh, well, I guess maybe they're right, you know. I mean, maybe I don't want to talk about this. Maybe I don't want to do a protest. Maybe I don't want to do this and get my name on a no-fly list, you know. Maybe I don't want to have my name in some sort of... total information awareness package. Now, maybe I don't want to be under suspicion by the Homeland Security or something like that. Maybe I don't want to go to Guantanamo. You know, maybe I'd rather take care of my family. It just becomes, they're so powerful. You know, what can't they do? You know, what can't they do to you? But I think basically, but most people don't think of it in that term. They're just sort of willing to give up that power. So I don't know what to count for that. I'm sure there are things, but...
Well, that's definitely the slippery slope. When you start to realize you're losing your liberty and that makes you too scared to want to even fight for it, it's just a matter of time before, you know, everybody's snitching on each other to the secret police to try to, you know, preemptive narking, preemptive ratting out of neighbors, that kind of thing.
Well, I know. I mean, of course, part of this comes from, you know, a little part of it comes from this 30 or 40 year campaign we had that started in the early 70s, a very concentrated campaign by these the right-wing interests, they were basically corporate interests, you know, let's put it that way, the corporate interest, you know, that was drawn up under Nixon's administration, not by the government, but by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to sort of reverse, you know, a lot of stuff that had been going on in the decades before then, and to build up this whole sort of counterculture, if you will, really, of these right-wing, you know, the Heritage Foundation, all these things, that just continually for 30 and 40 years now just push all this, you know, the state needs more power, we need more power to fight the communists, now we need more power to fight the Islamists, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, part of it is an outgrowth of this sort of deliberate, well-funded, I don't know what you want to call it, conspiracy or counter-revolution or whatever you want to call it.
Well, you know, I think maybe part of the reason that they get away with it is people's failure to understand what you did so well in encapsulating just a minute ago, this the Iron Triangle, I guess, is one way to put it, the revolving door, where basically you have all these people in and out of government and in and out of the corporations that sell weapons to the government. And like you said, they don't care. They're willing to spend, you know, unlimited amounts of money whining and dining and lobbying congressmen and so forth, because all their money is free. They can charge $900 for a toilet seat or $10 billion for an airplane.
Well,
and
yeah, it's our money. It's free to them. That's exactly. Well, this is another point that he makes in the book too. Is that you know, what we've been seeing is this massive, especially under the Bushes, but we've been seeing it for decades, a massive transfer of public money just straight into these few corporations, these powerful corporations, which then plow the money back into the political system on behalf of their underlings, and you have this whole skewed playing field, you know, so that, you know, poll after poll shows that people don't, if you ask them individually, they don't approve of this policy, they don't approve of that policy, they don't approve of this policy, all down the line for Bush, you know, especially when Bush was running on. I remember the polls in 2004. You know, these people showed, oh, we don't believe this ABCDFG that Bush holds. And yet, they said, oh, but I'll vote for Bush, because they didn't even know he held those positions. So, I mean, you have this whole skewed, they can skew the media, they can skew the perceptions, they can skew the playing field, because if they have all this money that's poured back into it. And that's why I was saying, that's one of the reasons I've always said that the war, the Iraq war, has been a win-win situation. No matter what happens, this money gets poured back into our political system and our society and helps skew it further and further and further toward the sort of inequality and injustice and behavior in favor of this small clique. And so that's part of what's happening now.
Yeah, it sounds like everybody climb in the handbasket. We're on our way to hell right now.
Yeah.
I don't know how long it's going to be before the big break comes, but it's coming eventually. And I guess, as Dr. Paul says, it'll probably be the destruction of our currency that really leads the way to all this.
Well, that's certainly going apace. I'll have to say that, you know. Especially if someone living overseas and any kind of, you know, I mean, you can see it very starkly how weak the dollar is, and you know, that's really that's a good thing. That's one thing that's going to happen. I mean, obviously, it's sliding and sliding and sliding. It's going to hit a tipping point one of these days when when the Chinese start dumping their dollars and everybody else starts dumping their dollars because they just can't deal with it anymore. I mean, what's the point of having, I mean, when the dollar is, when it gets down to what, 25 cents on the pound? What's the point of holding dollars anymore?
Yeah, well, good question. You know, Lou Rockwell asked on his blog, kind of rhetorically, I guess, the question remains unanswered for certain, but the question is, do they have wars so that they can inflate, or do they inflate so they can have wars? And it's kind of an interesting little catch-22 there.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know, but as we say, it's always a win-win situation with these guys, which is one thing that we just have to somehow find a way to stop, and I don't know how to do that, actually. So until they feel some sort of pain, you know, why should they stop? Because they obviously don't care about our pain, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't really have any good ideas for fixing it either, but I do know, and in fact, I guess I was asked the question in the comments on my blog, whether I feel, and I guess the other guys that hang around the stress blog, whether they feel like we're all just pissing in the wind, and I actually have thought about this for a long time, I guess really in deciding to, you know, try to work at this kind of stuff at all, that I don't really mind knowing that nothing about history is going to change because of anything I said or did, but at least, you know, I can call the score on the way down, and for people who are interested and do want to know the truth, whether they can do anything about it either, at least they'll have a place to go to find out what's going on. And, you know, chris-floyd.com, your blog, Empire Burlesque, is a great place to stay on top of things. I really appreciate your analysis in print, and as always on this show, Chris.
Thank you. Okay, well, thanks. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the point, I'll just make a quick point if you have a second, was that
sure.
You're right. I mean, even if things do look hopeless or however hopeless, I mean, I don't know any other choice but to keep fighting and keep trying this, keep trying that, keep trying the other, and, you know, just sort of keep yourself in the ball game somewhere because you never know what's going to happen. And also, and then, as you say, I mean, if the only thing you do in the end is to have registered your protest and it's stood up, you know, for what you feel is the truth, I mean, what else can you do if you want to have any sort of dignity as a human being? And if you have any belief whatsoever in the human project, you know, of helping, you know, move things forward, if not for you, then for your children, or for 100 years from now, for 200 years from now, they can look back and see that one person did this or some people did that. I mean, if that's all we're left with, that's all we're left with. I don't see any other choice, I mean, other than to just quit, and then that's just being complicit.
Yep. You know, I'm sorry, one more Ron Paul reference in this interview. The first time I interviewed Ron Paul, I asked him the last question of the interview, if there's only one Ron Paul in the whole Congress, what's the point of all this, kind of? What hope do we really have? And his answer was just, well, you know, you don't, unless you have psychic powers, he didn't say that, but you can't predict the future. None of us can predict the future, and our job is to just keep teaching people about liberty and try to do the right thing, and you never know what's going to happen. I'll tell you what, 1985, we didn't think the Soviet Union was going to cease to exist within 4 or 5 years, and yet the whole thing came crumbling down. And, you know, I could say that in the time since then, there's been, well, you know, somebody was complaining on the antiwar.com blog that, yeah, so here's a half-hour interview of Dar Jamil, but, you know, we can hear that kind of stuff everywhere nowadays. It's not like he's a voice in the wilderness anymore. So, you know, I think there's been some progress made, if that's what we're complaining about, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's probably a specious complaint. But, yeah, I mean, of course, there are more voices. It is, of course, you know, when I started... I mean, I remember a time, I don't mean to be sort of bragging, I remember a time when I was one of the few people, at least I could run across out in print, who was even criticizing Bush, and this is right after 9/11. And, you know, I've seen this happen over the last few years plenty of times. I see all these things I used to write about years ago and get ragged upon, you know, and told that I was a traitor and all this stuff. And now, as you say, now it's in Time Magazine, you know, somebody's writing about it. So, the point is to, as you say, is a good reference to the Soviet Union. I mean, what must it look like to Andrei Sakharov in 1975 under Brezhnev? Like, well, there's no way to overthrow this system, and nothing will ever change. It just, you know, it's completely powerful. It's completely, you know, entrenched. But you just keep going. You just keep going. You didn't stop. You didn't say, oh, well, I might as well give up on this democracy stuff. You just keep going, and you just keep going, because, as you say, you don't know what's going to happen. And, I mean, I don't know any other way to do it.